You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 99 by Rudolf Steiner. 14 lectures entitled Rosicrucian Wisdom, translated by Johanna Collis. This is Lecture 1, given in Munich on the 22nd of May, 1907, entitled The New Form of Wisdom. The title of this course of lectures has been announced as titled Theosophy According to the Rosicrucian Method. By this is meant the wisdom that is primeval yet ever new, expressed in a form suitable for the present age. The mode of thought we are about to study has existed since the 14th century A.D. In these lectures, however, it is not my intention to speak of the history of Rosicrucianism. As you know, a certain kind of geometry, which includes, for instance, the theorem of Pythagoras, is taught in elementary schools today. The rudiments of geometry are learned quite independently of how geometry itself actually came into being, for what does the pupil who is learning the rudiments of geometry today know about Euclid? Nevertheless, it is Euclid's geometry that is being taught. Not until later, when the substance has been mastered, do students discover, perhaps from a history of the sciences, something about the form in which the teaching that is accessible even in elementary schools today originally found its way into the evolution of humanity. As little as the pupil who learns elementary geometry today is concerned with the form in which it was originally given to humanity by Euclid, as little need we concern ourselves with the question of how Rosicrucianism developed in the course of history. Just as the pupil learns geometry from its actual tenets, so shall we learn to know the nature of this Rosicrucian wisdom from its intrinsic principles. Those who are acquainted merely with the outer history of Rosicrucianism, as recorded in literature, know very little about the real content of Rosicrucian theosophy or wisdom. Rosicrucian wisdom has existed since the 14th century as something that is true, quite apart from its history, just as geometrical truths exist independently of history. Only a fleeting reference, therefore, will here be made to certain matters connected with the history of Rosicrucianism. In 1459, a lofty spiritual individuality, incarnate in the human personality, who bears in the world the name of Christian Rosenkreutz, appeared as the teacher of a small circle of initiated pupils. In 1459, within a strictly secluded spiritual brotherhood, the Fraternitas Rosae Crucis, Christian Rosenkreutz was raised to the rank of Equus Lapidis Arii, Knight of the Golden Stone. What this means will become clearer to us in the course of these lectures. The exalted individual, who lived on the physical plane in the personality of Christian Rosenkreutz, worked as leader and teacher of the Rosicrucian stream, quote, again and again in the same body, close quote, as esotericism puts it. The meaning of the expression, again and again in the same body, will also be explained when we come to speak of the destiny of the human being after death. Until far into the 18th century, the wisdom of which we are speaking was preserved within a secret brotherhood, bound by strict rules, which separated its members from the exoteric world. In the 18th century, it was the mission of this brotherhood to allow certain esoteric truths to flow by spiritual ways into the culture of Central Europe. That is why we see, flashing up in an exoteric culture, many things that are clothed, it is true, in an exoteric form, but which are in reality nothing else than outer expressions of esoteric wisdom. In the course of the centuries, a good many people have endeavored in one way or another, to discover the Rosicrucian wisdom, but they did not succeed. Leibniz, for example, tried in vain to get at the source of this wisdom. Yet Rosicrucian wisdom did light up like a flash of lightning in an exoteric work which appeared when Lessing was approaching the close of his life. I refer to Lessing's title, Education of the Human Race. Reading between the lines, if we are esotericists, we can recognize by its singular ending that it is an external expression of Rosicrucian wisdom. This wisdom lit up in outstanding grandeur in the man in whom European culture, and indeed international culture, was reflected at the turn of the 18th century, in Goethe. While he was still comparatively young, Goethe had come into contact with the source of Rosicrucianism, and he then experienced in some degree a very remarkable and lofty initiation. To speak of initiation in connection with Goethe may easily be misleading, so it is appropriate to mention something extraordinary that happened to him during the period after he had left Leipzig University and before he went to Strasbourg. He underwent an experience that penetrated very deeply into his soul and expressed itself outwardly in the fact that during the last period of his stay in Leipzig, he came very near to death. As he lay desperately ill, he had a momentous experience, passing through a kind of initiation. He was not actually conscious of it at first, but it worked in his soul as a kind of poetic inspiration, and the process by which it flowed into his various creations was most remarkable. It flashes up in his poem entitled The Mysteries, which his closest friends considered to be one of his most profound creations. This fragment is indeed so profound that Goethe was never able to recapture the power to formulate its conclusion. The culture of the day was incapable of giving external form to the depths of life pulsating in this poem. It must be regarded as coming from one of the deepest founts of Goethe's soul. It is a book with seven seals for all his commentators. As time went on, the initiation worked its way increasingly into his awareness, and finally, as he grew more conscious of it, he was able to produce that remarkable prose poem known as titled The Fairy Tale of the Green Snake and the Beautiful Lily, one of the most profound writings in all literature. Those who are able to interpret it rightly know a great deal of Rosicrucian wisdom. At the time when Rosicrucian wisdom was intended to flow gradually into the general life of culture, it happened, in a manner of which I need not speak further now, that a kind of betrayal took place. Certain Rosicrucian conceptions found their way into the world at large. This betrayal, on the one hand, and on the other, the fact that it was necessary for 19th-century Western culture to remain for a time on the physical plane, uninfluenced by esotericism, these two facts made it imperative that the sources of Rosicrucian wisdom, and above all its great founder, who since its inception had been constantly on the physical plane, should apparently withdraw. Thus, during the first half, and also during a large part of the second half of the 19th century, little of Rosicrucian wisdom could be discovered. Only now, in our own time, has it become possible to make this Rosicrucian wisdom accessible again, and allow it to flow into general culture. If we think about this culture, we shall discover the reasons why this had to be. I will now speak of two characteristics of Rosicrucian wisdom, which are important in connection with its mission in the world. One has to do with people's whole attitude toward this Rosicrucian wisdom, which is not the same thing as the esoteric form of Christian Gnostic wisdom. We must touch briefly upon two facts pertaining to the spiritual life, if we are to be clear about the fundamental character of Rosicrucian wisdom. The first of these is the relationship of the pupil to the teacher, and here again there are two aspects to consider. We shall speak first of what is termed clairvoyance, and secondly, of what is called, quote, belief in authority, close quote. Clairvoyance, the term is really inadequate, comprises not only spiritual seeing, but also spiritual hearing. These two faculties are the source of all knowledge of the world's hidden wisdom, and true knowledge of the spiritual worlds can come from no other source. In Rosicrucianism, there is an essential difference between discovering spiritual truths and understanding them. Only those who have developed spiritual faculties in a fairly high degree can themselves discover a spiritual truth in the higher worlds. Clairvoyance is the necessary prerequisite for discovering a spiritual truth, but only for discovering it. For a long time to come, nothing will be taught exoterically by any genuine Rosicrucianism that cannot be grasped by the ordinary logical intellect. That is the essential point. The objection that clairvoyance is necessary for understanding the Rosicrucian form of wisdom is not valid. Understanding does not depend upon the faculty of seership. Those who are incapable of grasping Rosicrucian wisdom with their thinking have simply not developed their logical reasoning powers to a sufficient extent. That is all. Anyone who has absorbed all that modern culture is able to give, who is not too lazy to learn and has patience and perseverance, can understand what a Rosicrucian teacher has to impart. Those who have doubts about Rosicrucian wisdom and who say that they cannot grasp it must not blame this on their inability to rise to higher planes. The fault lies in their unwillingness either to exert their reasoning powers sufficiently or to put experiences gained from general culture to adequate use. Just think of the tremendous popularization of wisdom that has taken place since the appearance of Christianity down to the present day, and then try to picture Christian Rosicrucianism as it was in the 14th century. Think of the relation of a human being, then living in the world, with his teachers. It was only possible to work by means of the spoken word in those days. On the whole, we fail to appreciate what tremendous development has taken place since that time. Think only of what has resulted from the invention of printing. Think of the thousands and thousands of channels through which, thanks to that invention, the highest achievements of culture have been able to flow into civilization. From books down to the most trivial newspaper article, you can perceive the innumerable channels through which countless ideas flow into life. These channels have only been open for humanity since that time, and they have had the effect of making the Western intellect assume quite different forms. The Western mind has worked quite differently since then, and the new form of wisdom had, necessarily, to reckon with this fact. A form had to be created which would be able to stand its ground in face of all that flows into life along these thousands of channels. Rosicrucian wisdom can hold its own against any objection, whether popular or highly scientific. Rosicrucian wisdom contains within itself the sources which enable it to counter every objection made by science. A true understanding of modern science, not the dilettante understanding, to be found even among university professors, but understanding that is free from abstract theorizing and materialistic conjectures, and is founded firmly upon facts, and does not go beyond them, can find from science itself the proofs of the spiritual truths of Rosicrucianism. A second point concerning the relationship between teacher and pupil in Rosicrucianism is that the relationship of the pupil to the guru, as the teacher is called in the East, is fundamentally different from that prevailing in other methods of initiation. In Rosicrucianism, this relationship cannot in any way be said to be based upon belief in a superior authority. Let me make this clear to you by an example drawn from everyday life. The Rosicrucian teacher wants a relationship with his pupil which is like that of a mathematics teacher with his students. Can it be said that students of mathematics look up to their teacher simply out of a belief in authority? No. And can it be said that students of mathematics do not need the teacher? Some people may argue that they do not, because they may have discovered how to teach themselves from good books. However, that situation differs from the one in which a student and teacher sit face to face. In principle, of course, self-instruction is possible. Equally, every human being, provided he reaches a certain stage of clairvoyance, can discover spiritual truths for himself. But this would be a much more lengthy path. It would be senseless to say, "My own inner being must be the sole source of all spiritual truths." If the teacher knows mathematical truths and imparts them to his pupils, the pupils no longer need to have a belief in authority, for they grasp these truths through the correctness inherent in them, and all they need do is understand them. So is it with all esoteric development in the Rosicrucian sense. The teacher is the friend, the counselor, one who has already lived through esoteric experiences, and now helps the pupils to do so themselves. Once someone has had these experiences, there is as little need for him to accept things on authority as there is in mathematics for him to accept on authority the statement that the three angles of a triangle add up to 180 degrees. In Rosicrucianism, there is no authority in the ordinary sense. It is simply a question of what is required for shortening the path to the highest truths. That is one side of the question. The other is the relation of spiritual wisdom to culture in general. These lectures will show you that it is possible for truth to flow directly into practical life. We are not setting up a system that is applicable in theory only. We are speaking of teachings which can be put to use in practical life by anyone who desires to know the deeper foundations of present-day worldly knowledge, and which allow spiritual truths to flow into everyday life. Rosicrucian wisdom must not stream only into the head, nor only into the heart, but also into the hand, into our manual skills, into our daily actions. It does not take effect as sentimental sympathy. It is the acquisition, by strenuous effort, of faculties enabling us to work for the well-being of humanity. Suppose some society were to proclaim human brotherhood as its aim, and were to do no more than preach brotherhood. That would not be Rosicrucianism. For the Rosicrucian says, imagine someone lying in the road with a broken leg. If 14 people stand around him in pity, but not one of them is able to help, the whole 14 together are of less importance than a 15th who comes, perhaps without any sentimentality at all, but is able to and actually does deal with the broken leg. The attitude of the Rosicrucian is that what counts is knowledge able to take hold of and intervene effectively in life. Rosicrucian wisdom considers that repeated talk about pity and sympathy has an element of danger in it, for continual harping on sympathy denotes a kind of astral sensuality. Sensuality on the physical plane is of the same nature as on the astral plane the constant wish to feel but never to know. Knowledge that is capable of taking effect in practical life, not, of course, in the materialistic sense, but because it is brought down from spiritual worlds, this is what enables us to work effectively. Harmony flows of itself from the knowledge that the world must progress, and it flows all the more surely because it arises quite naturally out of knowledge. You could say of someone who knows how to deal with a broken leg, but does not do so, that he neglects the sufferer because he dislikes people. Such a thing would be possible in the case of knowledge pertaining only to the physical plane. But it would not be possible for spiritual knowledge. There is no spiritual knowledge that would refrain from entering into practical life. This, then, is the second aspect of Rosicrucian wisdom, namely, that although it can be discovered only through the powers of clairvoyance, it can be understood by normal human reason. It may seem strange to say that in order to have experiences in the spiritual world, you must become clairvoyant, but that you need not be clairvoyant in order to understand what the clairvoyant sees. A seer who returns from the spiritual worlds and tells of what is going on there, bringing people knowledge that is necessary for humanity at the present time, can be understood if those who listen are willing to understand, for human beings are constituted in a way that makes it possible for them to understand. We shall begin by studying the sevenfold nature of the human being according to Rosicrucian teaching. We shall consider the whole of human nature as we see it before us. We shall learn to understand the nature of the physical body, about which so many think they know everything, while in fact they know nothing. As little as we can see the oxygen in water, but must separate it from the hydrogen in order to recognize it, as little do we see the real physical human being when we look at someone standing before us. The human being is a combination of physical body, ether body, astral body, and the other higher members, just as water is a combination of oxygen and hydrogen. The being before us is the sum total of all these members. If we are to see the physical body alone, the astral body must have separated from it. This is the condition in dreamless sleep. Sleep is a kind of higher chemical separation of the astral body, together with the higher members of our nature, from the etheric and physical bodies. But even then it cannot be said that we have the real physical body before us. The physical body is alone only at death, when the ether body too has left it. This has a direct and concrete bearing. I will make it clear to you by means of an example. Think of some particular part of the astral body. In the remote past, the pictures which the human being perceived in dim, shadowy clairvoyance worked very differently than do mental images today. These pictures were impressed, first of all, into the astral body. Let us suppose that at one time pictures of the three dimensions of space, length, breadth, depth, were impressed into the astral body. This picture of three-dimensional space, which was once impressed into the astral body through the old, dim clairvoyance, was carried over into the ether body. Just as a seal is pressed into liquid sealing wax, so did the astral picture impress itself into the ether body, which in turn molded the forms of the physical body. Thus the picture of three-dimensional space built an organ in a particular area of the physical body. Originally, there was a picture in the astral body of the three perpendicular directions of space. This picture impressed itself like a seal into wax, into the ether body, and a certain part of the ether body molded an organ in the interior of the human ear, namely, the three semicircular canals. You all have them within you. If they are in any way impaired, you cannot orient yourself within the three directions of space. You get giddy and cannot stand upright. Thus are the pictures of the astral body connected with the forces of the ether body and the organs of the physical body. The whole way that the human physical body is shaped is nothing else than a product of the pictures of the astral body and the forces of the ether body. Hence, those who have no knowledge of the astral and ether bodies cannot understand the physical body. The astral body is the predecessor of the ether body, and the ether body is the predecessor of the physical body. This is how complicated these things are. The three semicircular canals are a physical organ, just as is the nose. All noses differ from one another, although there may be a resemblance between the noses of parents and children. If you were able to study the three semicircular canals inside the human ear, you would find differences and resemblances, just as in the case of noses, for these canals may resemble those of one's mother or father. What is not inherited is the innermost spirit, the eternal core, which passes through successive incarnations. Individual talents and capacities are not determined by the brain. Logic is what it is. It is the same in mathematics, in philosophy, or in practical life. Differences in capacity only appear when logic is applied in areas involving particular physical organs, where knowledge depends, for instance, upon the functioning of the semicircular canals in the ear. Mathematical talent will be particularly marked when these organs are highly developed. An example of this is the Bernoulli family, which produced a succession of fine mathematicians. An individual may possess great incipient talent for music or some other art, but if he is not born into a human body, which has inherited the requisite organic structures, he cannot bring these talents to expression. So you see, the physical world cannot be understood without knowledge of how it is constituted. The Rosicrucian does not consider it his task to withdraw in any way from the physical world. Certainly not. For what he has to do is to spiritualize the physical world. He must rise to the highest regions of spiritual life, and with the knowledge there obtained, labor actively in the physical world, especially amongst human beings. This is the Rosicrucian attitude, the direct outcome of Rosicrucian wisdom. We are about to study a system of wisdom which will enable us to understand even the smallest things, and we shall not forget that the smallest thing in the world can be of importance to the greatest, that the smallest thing in its rightful place can lead to the highest of goals. The end of Lecture 1.